There was another question over here, sir. Oh, you wanted the answer to the question I started. Tough crowd. It was odd. You know, he said, what did they do to fix the problem on the carrier? They all their engineers couldn't solve the problem, and the Navy couldn't solve the problem. So finally, the project manager at Navy says, why don't you just have lunch with those blackguards, those nasty guys over in at Grumman? I mean, you guys are like 3 hours apart. Because the Hellcat doesn't bounce. You bounce, he doesn't bounce. I mean, what am I missing here, you know? So they had lunch one day, and at the end of 2 hours, the Grumman guy says, all right, I kind of like you. You know, you're Republican, I'm Republican. You need to change the charges, your nitrogen charge in your struts. Just change the charge. Change that? No problem. The airplane also had another little nasty habit. It can be overcome with skill and cunning, but you know the definition of an expert pilot is he who conducts his flying affairs in such a way that his expertise is not called upon. And this airplane in flight test had a bad tendency. You want to come across the stern of the aircraft carrier almost at stall speed. But if it does stall, you want a little warning in the flight controls, and you want a stall that's fairly wing flat. You don't want it to, oh, by the way, we're going to stall, and you're upside down. And this airplane had a bad tendency to do that. And so in the Dash 4s and earlier, they solved the problem with a little triangular apparatus that looks like part of the wing. You wouldn't even know the difference. Corsair questions, World War II, naval aviation. Why was the... never good at Reno. Now, I raced a Corsair at Reno, so this you asked, that was the wrong thing. The question was, for those of you who are much more intelligent than our questioner, why was the Corsair never good at Reno? You know, do you still beat your wife? There are partially true. The FG-1Ds and the F4U-1s and the Dash-4s and the Dash-5s and the Dash-7s, the Corsair was the first World War II airplane to achieve 400 miles an hour in level flight. That's pretty fast. But it did it at 24,000 feet. Because as you can see, the other thing that's interesting as you walk up to the airplane is how thick the wing is, as opposed to a Mustang, which is a laminar flow wing, and it's a very efficient wing. This is a thick wing, but the nice thing about a thick wing is you can put your landing gear up and away, and you can put a lot of bullets in it, and you can put a lot of what we call hard points for weapons, ordnance, and things like that. So down low, the average density altitude at Reno in September is about 10,000 feet. And so even with water injection, it's very difficult to get a good true airspeed down low. So they're always racing in the bronze. However, towards the end of the war, they came out with another model that they were trying to sell the Navy, the FG-2D. And there's one here, a blue one. Oh, it's down on Shell Square or whatever it is. And that airplane has a much larger engine, a 4360 as opposed to 2800. And if they're run right and if they stay together for the 7.5 interminable minutes that a race seems like, they will do well, but compared to the top four guys, they're tough to stay in a race. So somebody says to me, you want to go have a fight with a Mustang? Say, yeah, I'll see you at 20,000 feet. You know, then you get a chance. Okay, anything questions? Yeah, yes, sir. The fuel tank in front of the cockpit was self-sealing. Some of the Marines at land-based with the Corsairs, the FG-1Ds, certainly, the parts weren't always available, and in the early years, it was a new airplane, and so they had some leakage problems. But self-sealing really refers to if it's pierced by a bullet rather than a screwdriver, and yes, self-sealing. Okay, so yes, sir. He wants to know how badly Obama will lose. No, I'm sorry. He doesn't look like a well-educated guy, and his question is, at the average all-up fighting weight of a Corsair World War II with a density altitude of 14,500 feet, what is the max allowable load factor, or for Episcopals, it's G's, about 6.75, roughly. Any other reasonable questions? Sir, it does? Why does a radial engine have an odd number of cylinders? They don't all have an odd number. See, that's why I never took power plants. I'm an airframe guy. I don't know. His question was, why do most radial engines have an odd number of cylinders? Master Rod. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. Master Rod. Yeah. Sir, why is the cockpit so far back? It didn't have a lot of votes. You know, it started out up front over the center of the wing, which is a good place to be because of center pressure and center gravity and all those things that he can tell you about. But it kept getting pushed back. The engine compartment got bigger, more accessories. Then they put in that huge 255-gallon tank, and that pushed it way back, and it just ended up where it ended up. I don't think anybody asked the pilot when they were designing it, so it's way far back. Makes me think of the GB Racer with Jimmy Doolittle. One more question before we get to Korea, sir. Are there aerodynamic benefits or disadvantages to having a wing with a gull wing? To my mind, it ought to be more stable, which is what you don't want in a fighter. In a fighter, you want an airplane that's called dynamically unstable. You want to be able to have a very high roll rate. But the roll rate is very high. During the fly-off, they did write it up that the roll rate wasn't quite as good as they thought it might be, and then the ailerons got bigger. By the way, if you look at all the early Corsairs, the ailerons are made out of wood. Somebody always comes up and says, hey, I thought this was metal and this elevator is fabric. Well, it depends on the model. The farther the war went, the more aluminum was used and available and less fabric. But it has a great turn rate, I think. It's very maneuverable. And I don't think the gull ring really affects it. The only thing that's challenging is, if you're a pilot, is when you make a tremendous crosswind landing. You know, say you have a 25-knot crosswind landing. You come in, and you want to put the upwind wing down. Well, it's up. You know, so how far down can you get it? So that's kind of tricky. That's why it's better to fly jets. And the other thing is that when you're in real close formation and you're flying on a Corsair for the first time, you're trying to figure out, am I supposed to be up on this part of the wing or down on this part of the wing? So it's kind of interesting. Okay, any other questions? And we'll go to Korean War. So our prime fighter, sir, ma'am, sorry. Don't tell my wife I did that. Hose Nose, nickname was Hose Nose. There were other things that I can tell you after the show behind the bleachers, but 8 o'clock tonight if you're available. Yeah. So go to Korea, and the jets have come out. Very few people know that the first jet fighter for the Americans was the P-80, and there were actually four sent to Europe during the last 6 months of World War II. Love the sound of a Merlin. Has an even number of pistons. And
most of the time.
Yeah. Well spoken by a man that didn't pay for the maintenance. So jets were attempted to be introduced at the in the last few months of the war. The Germans were ahead of us with the ME-262 and the other one I forget. And but they were not very effective yet. They had some maintenance problems and training problems, stuff like that. So the jets didn't really come into play a lot towards the end, and a lot of our P-51s shot down jets. So we end the war, and then, of course, the Russians got their Germans, and the Americans got our Germans, and everybody does the rocket thing, and also we're working on the jet technology. So we start Korea with the P-80, which, if you see the T-33s, especially the beautiful red, white, and blue one with the stars on the tail and the red nose. T-33 is a stretch P-80. The P-80 is our primary fighter, and then very shortly thereafter, the F-86 comes aboard. But the Navy's having big challenges. I'll never forget walking around during between classes at the Academy, and they'd have bulletin boards with the latest news from the fleet on there. And the Baltimore newspaper had a small article, and it said 550 killed in naval aviation. Now, this is in the 60s, and we were not really in an air war with anybody, so 550 naval aviators killed got my attention. And what had happened is they had tallied up all the deaths in the Navy from 1949 to 1965, that had nothing to do with hostile environment. Just trying to bring jets aboard aircraft carriers in a tough environment. Catapults had to be changed. The decks had to be changed. So we go to Korea, and we have some starting to see a mixture of jets and props. And the Corsairs were assigned basically for their tremendous air-to-ground capability, but also they could do air-to-air. So here's the setting now. We have Korean War, terribly cold winters. We're initially successful in pushing the North Koreans back up towards the northern border, which they share with China. Chinese are threatening to invade North Korea and save their brothers. And the Leyte and the Boxer and other carriers are off the shore. And all of a sudden, the Marines call up and say, the Incheon Reservoir we're surrounded. And the estimates were between 80 and 150,000 Chinese had crossed the border very rapidly. They call out to the carrier and say, we have got to have some air support in here or we're going to lose a lot of people. And so Lieutenant Junior Grade Thomas J. Hudner Jr. is on his first cruise and is assigned number four in a four-ship, which is going to have a two-ship following. So we're going to launch six Corsairs, armed to the teeth, go in there and be available to work with the forward controllers, air or ground, and go after the bad guys. He was number four. Jesse Brown, the first African-American naval aviator. Navy was a little slower than the Army Air Corps. And Jesse Brown was number three. So he was his section leader and deputy flight leader. And Jesse and he are going in. Now, for the boring part's over, I'd like Captain Hudner to maybe share a little bit of his experience. If you want to read in detail about his mission, and you should, you can see it on our website, classicfighters.org. And also, he'll be available to sign autographs in the bookstore immediately following the talk. You want to say anything? Or
me?
Or either of you. I'm tired.
Well, I think we ought to let him talk. They didn't come to hear me talk.
Well, thanks very much, Doug. That's a very interesting presentation. I learned some things about the Corsair I hadn't known before.
Some of them are true.
This talk may be monitored. So, I finished up flight training in the summer of 1949. Went through Pensacola and Corpus Christi. They had the training program was broken down into several segments. They had multi-engine training in Corpus Christi, and then fighters also in Corpus Christi, but at a different place. The Navy had a lot of, at that time, had a lot of excess airplanes, all World War II, of course. And one of the training squadrons was Corsairs. And I got chosen to fly the Corsairs as opposed to the F-6F Wildcats. And it was a great airplane to fly. We went right into that from flying the SNJs or similar to the Air Force's T-6. We got about 100 hours of Corsair time before we got our wings, getting six landings on an aircraft carrier which operated off Pensacola.